So, tell me about last night.
Well, it wasn't what I expected. It had the perfect amount of spice.
Sounds hot.
It had all the flavor, and I wanted more. The ghost pepper wings from Popeyes are just so delicious.
Wait, I thought you were talking about your date.
Sometimes, things aren't always as they seem. Like Popeyes ghost pepper wings that have the perfect level of kick and flavor. Try them for only $5 today. Limited time at participating U.S. restaurants. Price may vary. Tax extra.
Love that chicken from Popeyes.
Paul, do you mind girls screaming all through your act?
No, we like them screaming, generally, all of us, but it's a bit much all the way through.
Yeah.
But we love them screaming.
Here. Bye.
Welcome to SATB 228A, being the first hour of the two-hour conversation I had with Dr. Christine Feldman Barrett, who I've long wanted to have on the show. It's funny that we had been corresponding for quite some time, going back well before the publication of her book, A Woman's History of the Beatles, which was first published by Bloomsbury a year ago in early 2021. And that was around the time that I'd reached out to her when I knew the book was coming and had her as a guest at the first Fab Four Con Jam. Some of you might have seen that. The Dueling Redheads segment with Christine and Aaron Weber having at it, discussing her book, which was one of these things that in the history of SATB, I have a lot of writers on the show. I have a lot of people that have written some really good books. Some of them are memoirs. Some of them are technical things like the Jerry Hammock series. And other things actually break new ground and do it so well that they become the definitive volume on the subject. And it's happened a few times. A couple that come to mind, well, certainly Dr. Bob and Laura Kortner's Yellow Submarine books, those two volumes. You will not need any more Yellow Submarine books once you've gotten through those two, because they've covered the subject so top to bottom thoroughly. You cannot do any better. Those are the books I recommend. There is the book on the Beatles' drug history, Riding So High, by Joe Gooden. Another thing, we'd done a show on that back before the book was written, and it is something that I think with Joe's book really lays out the groundwork, and certainly one can drill down deeper, but it covers the overview quite thoroughly. Another one I thought about was Billy Bragg's book on skiffle. That's another book that is absolutely the last word on the subject. And so it was with the history of the Beatles viewed through the prism of the women in their lives and the impact on women that followed them. It was a conspicuous omission that certainly when Aaron Weber and I talked about it, I think it was on one of her early appearances on the show, what needs to be explored further than has been to this point. And that was the subject that she offered her opinion on, which I agreed with. And neither one of us knowing that Christine Feldman was working on it. I don't know if she'd started at that point. I'm not sure how far back the work started on this book. But in any event, it was published last year and now is out in trade paperback, so everyone can afford this very essential volume to their Beatle literary canon. So it is one of those books that's come along that I think if you are a serious fan of the Beatles and serious about their history, it's absolutely essential. And as with Joe Gooden's book, I think that Christine's book really lays out the terrain, as it were, on the subject. And there's a lot of storytelling in this. I don't want anybody to be put off by the fact that she is a PhD, and it is, originally when it was published, Bloomsbury, one of these academic things that typically are so dense that they're not really for the general public. They're more for other academics. And trust me when I say I've been to enough of these symposiums at schools, at universities, on the Beatles to know that there's an awful lot of energy put into stuff that, if I'm being completely honest, I don't know who the hell they're intended for because they are so oblique. I cannot think, as deep a fan as I am, it's like, who the hell is this meant for? I don't know. It's so niche within a niche. I just don't understand. But this is not that. It is extremely readable. A lot of storytelling going on here. It's just a beautiful piece of work. I'm really happy not only that it exists, but to have Christine on the show to talk about it. And for the purposes of this discussion, we didn't get into a great deal of detail about what is in the book. Partly because, number one, I wanted to leave it open for a return visit, which will certainly happen. This was more an overview of the whole thing. I think it's something that you need to check out, and I wanted to sort of explain the purpose because Christine had the concern that the title might be off-putting to people, that it might be something accusatory or negative toward the Beatles, and it's not that at all. If I can read the description given online, A Woman's History of the Beatles is the first book to offer a detailed presentation of the band's social and cultural impact as understood through the experiences and lives of women. Drawing on a mix of interviews, archival research, textual analysis, and autoethnography, the scholarly work depicts how the Beatles have profoundly shaped and enriched the lives of women, while also re-examining key influential female figures within the group's history. So that pretty much tells you what you need to know. I was going to say broad outlines, but that might be taken the wrong way. In any event, it's the first of what will be probably a number of conversations, as with Aaron Weber, as another author that wrote something that is key and essential, The Beatles and a Historian's Book, which by now I would assume every one of you listeners has picked up on. But if you haven't, well, we'll have her back to further make the case if need be. But in any event, it was a great conversation. I was really happy to get to know Christine personally and discover, as you'll hear in the outset of the conversation, these sort of parallel lives that we had as kids growing up in the suburbs of Chicago and discovering the Beatles and getting in and the path that it led us on, not least into forming bands. And you'll hear a bit of that. I haven't asked her yet, but I may be able to make available to anybody who's really interested some of the tracks. We'll be hearing segments of them in the show, but if anybody's curious and wants to hear more, I think maybe we can make that available in some fashion. You probably want to hear that because I know I did. I thought, wow, this is great. And it was so cool to hear another band mining the same territory because besides being Beatle fans, we were huge 60s heads and also drawn into the world of punk and post-punk, that sort of late 70s, early 80s stuff. A lot of it straight out of England. I will cop to being an Anglophile, as I think Christine will too. So we had that going on. Anyway, conversation, this first half starts out with us sort of comparing notes on our backgrounds. Once I got a driver's license, I would hit the city regularly. And so Wax Trax, which I think you cited on Twitter not that long ago, that was one of my haunts. And back in the day, before it became a record label,
because I was so into both punk and 60s stuff. That was like Mecca. They had everything.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think we have that in common because my parallel tracks were always the Beatles, everything 60s. I'm obsessed with it. And then when I got to be a teenager, post-punk, everything that was going on sort of in the mid-80s and everything that had come slightly before that my friends and I were still catching up on. I really love your podcast, so thanks for inviting me on.
It's weird that we're first now talking face-to-face when we've had so many email exchanges and stuff, and it occurred to me, it's like, wow, we've never actually talked. We've never had a phone call.
I know.
I feel like I know you so well, and the book is so amazing. It's like, if I have an idea for something that I think this is a book that should be written, and I know I can't do it, but somebody comes along and not only do they like cover all the bases I would have, but they go even beyond that. It's like, wow, it wasn't meant to be for me to write it, but the person came along, the right person did it. And I'm so glad for that. Before I even knew that this existed, you know, I don't know how long you've been working on it, but before it was made public. So going back a few years, I first had Aaron Weber on the show in 2017. And at some point, I don't think it was in our first conversation, maybe it was, but maybe it was in the second one. And we talked about what's a big major gap in the Beatles scholarship that really hasn't been addressed. And she's like, the women's perspective. And lo and behold, Christine comes along and fills that gap like so quickly and so beautifully. So I'm thrilled that the book is out, that you did it as perfect as anybody could. And the thing that people need to know is that despite it being published at Bloomsbury, which, you know, you automatically think academia is going to be so dense and so thick, as a lot of that stuff tends to be, it isn't. It is so readable. It's astonishingly reader friendly. I feel no qualms about recommending it to people. Like, you know, other things, I'm like, well, I think it's a great book, but you're not going to get 10 minutes into it. You know, you checked all the right boxes, and I appreciate that. So I'm so glad you did it.
Thank you. Well, in terms of the writing style, and I've talked with other people about this too, whether they're in academia or not, that the writing style, the way that you present your information, is so important because obviously you want people to read the book. And of course, there's that aspect of the academic side, you know, and wanting to educate people. And that's the core purpose of the book too. But it's always, always, always been important to me that the ideas really come across and that people are grabbed by the book, you know, and they want to keep reading it because otherwise, really, what's the point? People aren't going to get the information they want. I want people to enjoy the book. And basically, I've always wanted to write things that I would want to read. So this is a book that I wanted to have out there. And if I wasn't going to write it, hopefully somebody else would have done it. But I was just in the right position. It was the right place and the right time to be able to pursue the project. But yeah, the readability of it is so important to me, especially because it's this topic.
I would have thought going into it, and we can get into how you got down this particular path, but one thing that I thought about it when it had been suggested and Aaron had mentioned it, there were other people that had said to me back when, you should do a book profiling the women, like the main ones in the Beatles history. And I said, great idea. But part of the thinking process when you're sort of figuring out if this is something I can put the time into is, it's so big a subject. It's so daunting. And I know that for plenty of people I've talked to that are aspiring writers that don't know how to get the first step going because it does seem so intimidating just to write a book. And I've always advised them, well, baby steps, you know, do a little skeleton outline and then other things will come to you. You don't have to have this engraved in stone, but know what topics you want to cover and it will flesh itself out of its own accord. But that was one that I could not think of a way of what would be an angle that would do the subject justice without leaving major omissions. And it just was one of these things I just thought, it's too big. Maybe people will do it bite-sized or something, but you covered the scope of it and had the sort of macro level to it as well, which not only in terms of storytelling is great, like Liverbird's stuff as an example, but it sort of sets the stage for if somebody wants to come along and take off pieces of it and go into deeper study of them, they can do that. But you fired the shot across the bow, I feel, at this point, academically. So kudos. And I always hate sounding like I'm so effusive when I have guests on, but I really, really enjoyed it. And I really, really want people to read it. I love the fact that now it's out in paperback, so it is within reach that people don't want to shell out $130 for can do so. And I guess where I wanted to start was we'd had email exchanges and stuff, and you've described yourself as an ACCA fan, which is a great term for, you know, it's sort of what I'm doing too, although I don't have the PhD and I don't have the credentials. I'm just sort of a pretender that tries to come off as smart and use big words and try to elicit smarter people than me.
Not a pretender, Robert.
I don't have the alphabet behind me. So in any event, I would think that as we just talked about off the air, our similar backgrounds and being Chicagoans from birth, that maybe it was our fandom that sort of set us on the path well before we thought of being serious scholars about the Beatles. What came before that was making music. And I could say for myself, my Beatle fandom had a lot to do with me taking up an instrument. I'm not going to be presumptuous and assume it was the same for you, but let's hear, did you grow up around other musicians or was your fandom something that wanted to make you become a professional musician yourself?
Definitely. And it does start with the Beatles 100% because when I first heard the Beatles, and I always try to remember the first time, and I think it's so difficult for people who are second generation fans because in a way, the Beatles music was always around. Even if, for instance, your parents didn't have the albums. My parents actually didn't have the albums. It was my sister, who's 5 years older than me, who started bringing them into our household, really. But even before she did, and that would have been maybe like 1978 or something. So I was 7, she was 12. That's when she started bringing in, say, the Blue album, things like that. But even before that, I would say 1975, when we moved from one suburb of Chicago to another, the landlords that we had in Evanston, where we initially lived, I think their daughters probably were already at university or maybe in their 20s, and they had left behind a collection of 45s that were all from the 60s. And we got them, I think when we moved out, they just gave them to us. And I think she had actually, their daughter, one of their daughters had been a babysitter. And so we knew them, they gave us these records. And among them were a bunch of the Capitol Beatles singles. So we had Yesterday and what was it, Act Naturally on the side. We had Paperback Writer and Rain, which was big favorite. 8 days a week, and I don't want to spoil the party. So I always go back to listening to those singles when I was about 5 or 6 years old. I think 5 years old, actually, when I first heard those. And so for me, the Beatles quickly became all and everything. And so even as I grew up and in my adolescence and teenage years in Chicago, got really into what we could describe as post-punk. Some people might today describe it as alternative music, but basically anything that was coming from England, mostly. I mean, some of it was American, but I really got into that. And at that point, when I was a teenager, I did want to manifest my interest in music into playing, but I didn't really have the resources or the support necessarily at the time. I had played clarinet in grade school in the school band when I really had wanted to play the drums, but I wasn't encouraged by the music teacher. She thought I didn't have the aptitude for it. She was probably right. I think I tried to play the drums later and it wasn't a big success at all. But by the time I got to university, and I happened to go away for university to the West Coast to Bellingham, Washington, which is about an hour and a half north of Seattle, an hour south of Vancouver. I moved there in the fall of 1989. So grunge was really just exploding in that area at the time. So my college town actually had a really great music scene that was very diverse, and it was very much encouraging of a DIY ethic. So I bought a bass, taught myself how to play. I was also lead singer in an all-girl rock band.
Was that Hussy?
Hussy was the band that came after that, where I was playing bass guitar and singing mainly backup, some lead vocals. But the first band I was in that was an all-girl rock band was called Plum Nelly. I was lead singer of that, and we never played Beatles covers. I don't think we played many covers at all, either of those bands. But my desire to go into music was really strong at that point, and I did have sort of the infrastructure in that place to do it, the community of people who were supportive of that. And then in my 20s, I lived in Portland, Oregon, which is where I eventually met Luther.
Yes.
Attaboy, Luther!
Again, I found myself in sort of the, I would say, I think I moved there in 1997 and was there for about 4.5 years. And that's where I created the sort of mod girl singer thing, which I called myself Christine Darling. And it was a bit of an ode to, say, Marianne Faithfull. And I would wear pretty sort of mod outfits. And by that time, I had bought a Rickenbacker 3, I think it's the 330 model. So it's not the 325, but it looks very similar to the 325 that John Lennon played, you know, early on.
Right. The black one everybody knows from the Sullivan shows and that era.
Exactly. So I wanted that look, and I even toyed with the idea of doing this one woman Beatles tribute. It never kind of happened, but anyone who was part of the Portland music scene at that time knew that there were all sorts of tribute bands. There was a Kinks tribute band. There was even one for Guided by Voices. So it wasn't necessarily all 60s bands. I know there was one for the Rolling Stones as well. There wasn't one for the Beatles. And I thought, well, maybe I should just do it. But it was an idea that never quite manifested. So the Beatles were always present. For me, they're always sort of the origin of everything that I have loved about music. So they've always been the jumping off point for musical adventures, for all sorts of adventures, really. And obviously, at this point, many years later, it's turned into writing a book about them. Even before I decided to go for a PhD, for instance, I've always loved writing. And I think that's always been my strongest suit, you know, in terms of even now as an academic, in terms of teaching or researching and writing, I really think I'm best at the research and writing. So I'm glad I've been able to shift that love of the Beatles into more of the writerly space. Because I loved playing music. I had so much fun. But was I going to be a professional musician? No. I didn't think that was going to happen, even though I would have loved for that to be true, but it was clear to me at some point that that wasn't going to be my path.
Yeah, it's funny. We have very similar paths as far as that goes, and I think things worked out the way they were meant to. The story of a love of Beatles music putting people on a trajectory that would place them in the world of finding their identity as a creative people and as a vocation. It's so universal from probably 63 in England, 64 in America on that people's lives were changed. You might have heard the conversation with Allison and Carol and Deb about how their fandom propelled them on this path. It's amazing how something meant to entertain just became this life force for so many people. And I guess that's why we keep going back to it. No matter where we find ourselves as writers, as musicians, as teachers, as any line of work, you know, people designing fashions and things like that. If they had a love of the Beatles early on, there's a million different ways you can spin that and still be true to that passion in your way, sort of feeling like you're honoring them for what they gave to you by doing high quality work or whatever. It's just an amazing, amazing phenomenon.
It really is. And I think it speaks so much to what the Beatles were tapping into. Somewhat magically, I don't think anyone can adequately explain what was going on there. You know, we can have this sort of analysis of a blow by blow of how the Beatles got together, the friendships, you know, the group dynamics. We can analyze that in depth, in detail, and people do, obviously. But there's something that's inexplicable about it all that is just pure joy, pure positivity, you know, all these things that make the human experience worthwhile. I think the Beatles were able to distill that somehow in their songs and also in demonstrating how to be creative people, how to be kind people, how to make life interesting, how to live a life that you want to live. You know, I think they were such great examples of the possibilities of existence, you know? I mean, I don't mean to sound so existentialist or something.
But it is absolutely 100% true.
Yeah. You know?
But that's the thing is there are people out there that you try to quantify it because that's the terminology most people can feel are in solid ground when trying to explain the unexplainable. And it still doesn't satisfy fully. You know who Peter Sagal is?
No.
He's a guy on NPR, the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me quiz show.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I was at some event where I was sitting next to him. And when he caught wind of why I was there, the whole Beatle thing, and he demanded of me, so why the Beatles? And I found myself, hum, 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 you know, how do I explain the unexplainable? And it's like, no matter what I put on the table, because you immediately gravitate toward all the things you just said. And he's like, nah, it's like, well, what do you want? Either you get it or you don't. Either you feel something or you don't. And there are plenty of people that the Beatles are like, eh, you know, they easily dismiss them because it hasn't reached them in whatever way. Although doubtless there are things influenced by the Beatles that did connect with them. I would never impose fandom on people that way. It's like, you, there's something seriously wrong with you if you don't get the Beatles. So what? You just try to take from it what works for you, project it out, you know, just absorb whatever you get in terms of messaging beyond the music, because it's always beyond the music. And if you do it in a way that you feel is true to what the Beatles gave you and put that back into the world, that's like its own reward. And it doesn't matter whether people are fans of the Beatles or not at that point. You're paying it forward, as it were. And even now I'm saying these words, I'm thinking, this sounds so stupid, but I think it makes sense on some kind of level to somebody out there. I don't know.
It absolutely does make sense. And I think Paul McCartney, Ringo Starr at this point, they must have heard so many stories and had these moments where fans have run into them and the fan is completely speechless and all they could say is sort of, thank you, or you changed my life, you know? And I'm sure they've had so, so many experiences like that. And yet, how wonderful for them as human beings to know that what they've done has really brought so much joy to people in different ways. And I think that is the true essence of the Beatles music, the whole Beatles phenomenon, is that they've brought that happiness to people in multiple ways. And I guess with the book, I really wanted to show what that meant for women. And that's why it is a qualitative analysis. It is what people in academia might call audience studies or fan studies, you know. But essentially, in terms of a cultural history, I really wanted to try to demonstrate two things. And that is, of course, the impact of the Beatles on women's lives, whether at a distance by fans or the women who were closest to them. You know, what can we know about that relationship? How can we see it maybe in a new way that hasn't been discussed quite as much? And of course, the influence, the impact that women had on the Beatles and the Beatles had on women. But also, I've always been such a fan of the 1960s, everything to do with the 1960s. And obviously, the Beatles transcend the 1960s, as does their fandom. But with that starting point, say, of 1960 in Liverpool, what has happened in terms of women in society, what women feel that they're empowered to do, that tracks with the changes during the 1960s, the changes within the Beatles themselves as individuals, you know, how they experienced that change. I just was so fascinated with that socio-historic context. You know, here are the Beatles. They're at the center of it all in terms of youth culture, in terms of pop culture. They're one of the biggest phenomena of the 20th century. And parallel to that, women's lives are really changing. And the Beatles are part of that change for the women who I interviewed, right? And just looking at all the historic documents too, the old magazine and newspaper articles, looking at what kind of books were being written at that time about women in society, you know, that to me, I just felt was such a fascinating thing to look at. And of course, subjectively, and I think all academics or all writers about anything, you have to have that personal curiosity and interest in what you're researching and writing about. And so as a second generation Beatles fan, as a female fan, as somebody who played music for a while, these are all the things that propelled me to want to know more, and not just about these fascinating figures like Astrid Kircher and Yoko Ono and Linda Eastman McCartney. I wanted to also just really ask women, either who had that first generation experience of being there in the moment in real time and what that was like, but also people like myself, and then women who are even much younger, where I thought, wow, you know, this is really incredible how it just seems to keep going and going. And what do the Beatles mean to these younger women who have also grown up at a time where some of the biggest rock stars and pop stars in the world are women now, which wasn't the case when the Beatles were around. So it all comes back to that inexplicable feeling of why you connect so deeply with a particular artist. Obviously, like you said, there are people who don't have that deep fascination and connection with the Beatles. It could be someone else that they really feel drawn to in terms of a musical artist. But the fact that the Beatles' appeal has been so long-term and seems to just continue on and on, that's something that should be fascinating to everyone, even people who aren't huge Beatles fans themselves. But the fact that we're already onto the third, maybe fourth generation of having the Beatles in people's lives, that's pretty incredible.
And the name of it is A Sprout of a New Generation. It shows Paul McCartney coming up from the earth, like grown a sprout, a start, a new dawn. You see, the Beatles are the original. They started the look, everything. And they are the greatest group out. And here is, see, if you notice, he's like growing. And I like the oil paint, and I love to present his paint in the pool. And I love him to have it, and I love to meet him. Because,
Do you think you have any chance of meeting him?
Well, I don't really know. It's really a luck because a lot of people meet them because they know somebody. But I would like to give Paul this and show him I'm a true fan and that, you know, and that I wouldn't tear him apart, speak to him like a decent human being, And that, Dad, he's the, really the greatest in show business.
It sounds like you have sort of a crush on Paul McCartney.
Yes, that's true. I love all the Beatles, but Paul's my favorite.
On that note, I promise we'll circle back to the book, but you just touched on something that I wanted to address while it's fresh. And it's not as though we haven't spent enough time on Get Back lately, but I personally think that just based on anecdotal stuff around me, yes, somebody quantified the data and said for the Peter Jackson doc that the majority of viewers were 55 and older, and that's great. So we know it was boomers and maybe the first generation and a half or so of Beatle fandom. But I know from personal experience, stories I've heard from people have talked to me that quite a number of young people who wouldn't necessarily be automatically drawn to this kind of thing got sucked into it. It resonates as reality TV to them. You can walk into the room during the 2.5 hours of an episode and it's like, hear these conversations that are like something out of the kind of stuff that they're used to. You know, there's not something particularly happening or plot driven at that moment, but it is the kind of thing that has become entertainment in the last 20 odd years or so. So it resonates, it catches them. And the Beatles were so modern always. So it's not like you're necessarily looking at something all dated and stale and all that stuff. There's something they project that was always ahead of the curve. And even now, 50 plus years later, you don't have to be of that generation. You can be a young person and there'll be something to engage it, whatever thing it is. So I wanted to get your impressions because your sensibility as a woman, ACA fan, and generation 1.5 or whatever you term it, after the Beatles. What were your impressions? What did you get out of it? And was there anything that surprised you going into it based on your own deep study? You must have had more than a little familiarity with it.
I can remember the first time seeing Let It Be, and that was at Beatle Fest in probably 1979, maybe 1980. So I was very young.
I was probably in that room.
You were probably in that room with me, yeah. And my memory of that is, first of all, seeing what was happening on the screen, it did come across to me as seeming rather tense, for sure.
Did you have any preconception going in? Did you know enough about it to know that this is termed a breakup film or anything like that?
No, I wouldn't have. I have to say that as a young girl, I found the late Beatles music and their image harder to latch onto. And it's interesting to me because the Gen Z people on Twitter or the millennials, they love that era of the Beatles, from what I can tell. They love Paul McCartney with the beard. When I was a little girl, I thought, no, 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 I do not want the Beatles like this. Because I think from early on, I was really such a fan of that mid-Beatles period.
65, 66?
Absolutely. And that still is my sweet spot in terms of music, in terms of their groovy style. I love the Beatles in that period.
It seemed to get a bit of a revamp, a reboot, and not because of anthology, but around that period of Britpop, 95. It's like if they weren't channeling 66 Beatles, I don't know what was.
Exactly, exactly.
The old back lawn, where I exercise daily. Starstruck, starstruck over you, starstruck. I'm struck dumb by you, starstruck. I struck out my luck, I was always.
So maybe that being a Gen Xer, really loving Britpop as well, I think I've always just hovered in that area. So I remember as a little girl thinking, I don't really get this part of the Beatles story. And I would have known, obviously, it was closer to the end of their career as a band. It seemed very tense. My other strong memory of that first screening was people booing and hissing when Yoko appeared on screen, which I thought was really weird. I thought, why are adults, you know, booing and hissing at this person on screen? It just didn't make sense to me. I thought, do adults do that sort of thing? Okay.
So you didn't have the conventional wisdom at the time, Yoko Ono. That's the woman who broke up the Beatles.
This is an interesting question because I was trying to remember when I first knew who the wives and girlfriends were. And it comes down, I know people listening will not be able to see this.
Oh, my first Holy Bible.
This was the very first Beatles book. The Beatles, An Illustrated Record, was the first book I would have seen about the Beatles. Again, when I was, I would say probably 8 years old, maybe seven. And my parents' friends, we were over at their house and they had a hardcover copy of it. And I remember looking at the women, how they appear. And I have to tell you that yesterday I went through the book again to see the images of the women, like where do they come up in the book? And the most photos in there are of Yoko out of all the women in the Beatles story.
More than Linda?
More than Linda. There's only one photo of Linda, at least in the part of the book. This is obviously the version that came out. And I can't remember, you probably would know this, if the original edition of this had a section about the solo years in the 70s.
Yeah, it did.
Okay, okay. So there are more photos of her in that section. But in the section that's just about 1960 to 1970, there's only one photo of Linda, and that's from their wedding. And she's shaking the hand of the person who married them. And that's it. But Yoko, the first images you see of her are from the Two Virgins cover. So there she is naked, right? And then the other photo of her is, you can barely see her and John is kind of protecting her. And there's a swarm of police around them as they're coming out of court after the 1968 drug bust, right? So they're coming out of court.
The Life with the Lions back cover.
Yep, that's right. So it was interesting to revisit to see where do the women come up visually, because as a child, I would have been more focused on the photos than the text. And there are barely any images of Cynthia. I think there are a couple. There's one of Maureen and Ringo, and it's their wedding photo. There are a few small ones of Patty in there. So what I wanted to say is that that was probably from this book. Those were the first images I saw of Yoko, for example, but I still couldn't understand when I saw Let It Be why there was such an antagonistic response to her. I really didn't understand that part of the story and the fact that there was this anger directed towards her, I guess you could say, and hostility. I didn't understand that part. So it was really interesting for me in that respect, as it was, I think, for a lot of people, to see the editorial choices that Peter Jackson made with Get Back in regards to Yoko being there. And I know there have been all sorts of discussions around that. Why is she seen, quote unquote, in a more favorable light in this version of that footage? But I think the way that both Yoko and Linda are presented in Get Back is really interesting because we see Yoko there as we knew she would be at John's insistence. She is there with him. And I was just thinking about my experience being in recording studios, and I actually never really loved that part of making music. I thought being in the recording studio was a little bit boring, and I don't think I would have liked to have gone along with, say, a boyfriend to his recording session. I don't think I would have enjoyed that, because when I was recording with Hussey, for instance, and I did take a few recording classes myself, both in high school and at university, I'm not that kind of technical person. I'm just not into what goes on there. So I could understand why Yoko is breaking open a newspaper, or she's doing calligraphy, or she's reading, she's writing letters.
You got to occupy yourself.
Yeah. And that she's really there because John is such a strong-willed character. If he said, I absolutely have to have you there, I'm sure she would have never said no. And then with Linda, I love that you do see her taking photographs. And circling back around to your original question about the younger generations responding to the film, and I guess, you know, my keen eye was looking specifically in Twitter for tweets and comments from younger Beatles fans about Yoko and Linda, that they're so supportive and really fans of Yoko and Linda both. And I think it's easy to forget now how much Linda was also given flack, especially post-Beatles when she was in Wings. And you'll remember this, Robert, the really cruel things that were said about Linda in terms of musical ability or lack thereof, but also her looks, that she was just not an attractive woman. That was something that was said a lot. Actually, in Aaron Weber's book, she mentions that horrible joke that circulated, "What do you call a dog with wings?" I mean, seriously, horrible, horrible. And so it's lovely to see the younger generation of Beatles fans saying, "Wow, Linda is so gorgeous and beautiful, and look at her taking photos," and it counters those negative points of focus that were put on Yoko especially, but Linda as well. And like I said, I think a lot of people today do forget how poorly Linda was sometimes treated, especially in the 70s.
And even later than that, when that tape began circulating on radio of the isolation from, I think it was Nebworth, of them singing "Hey Jude," and it was just the Linda track on the na-na-nas. You know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it was a punchline for a while. I do think that speaks a bit to the sensibilities of younger generations who didn't grow up with the Beatles myth of them all on pedestals, and conversely, the demonization of Yoko and Linda. They didn't have that, and therefore they could approach it with fresh eyes and ears and judge on their own merits what they were seeing and experiencing. It's like, oh, it's funny that it works both ways, and you've got people at a distance from the original fandom that are a lot harder on the personal characters of the Beatles when they know stuff about their personal history, has nothing to do with the music, and therefore they don't exalt them the same way that for us older fans, it's like, well, yeah, that was John, but we find ourselves sort of trying to spin some kind of excuse. And that extends into certainly the people writing the books, which I've commented on the shows before. Certain people who can tell where their personal fandom lies among which Beatle, depending on how many words they spin excusing bad things.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the younger generation, especially I would say the people who are in their late teens and 20s now. And that's a trend that we see on college campuses and so on, that young people will really call out what they see as inappropriate bad behavior by anyone.
And it's reflexive to tear down the perceived wisdom. If you're the generation before you, is like, these are great guys and you should like them and all that. And they're going to be like, wait a minute, what about this? What about this? You know, I see it in my own kids, and it's just, it's, we did it ourselves. We did. What's so great about Sinatra? I think he was a jerk.
Right. Right. Didn't he call women broads? You know,
right.
how was that good?
Right.
But yeah, with the Beatles, you know, the thing with my book and something that worried me a little bit when I was putting it out there and given the name of it, there was a little bit of worry that some people without actually reading the book would think that it's some sort of critique of the Beatles as men, that it was going to be this kind of, well, the Beatles weren't that great, and this is what women have to say about the Beatles, and it's all a big critique. As you know from reading the book, Robert, that is absolutely not what the book is.
Right, right. But people are reactive and tribal, and they see things, and they circle the wagons, thinking, you know, oh, yet another attack on white males, just like the secret racism of the Beatles for people hearing Commonwealth for the first time.
Right.
It's silly. It's clickbaity, stupid stuff that's more indicative of the people doing it than is about anything of any validity whatsoever. But it's great to go off on these tangents and all kinds of cool, fun Beatles stuff. But I do want to focus on the book. And one of the things that I wanted to address, and I don't know if you've talked about this in other interviews, but as a fan, as somebody that Illustrated Record came along as the first thing, I think that's so true of people around our age. That was certainly among my first five books back when there was about six books to be had. When you were absorbing the literature, and then there was like the floodgates sort of opened post-1980, starting with Shout and all this other stuff coming out, that was a big era for Beatle books, The Love You Make and all that stuff. Were you consciously or subconsciously picking up on this omission in the telling of their story, not just by the people that were doing it, but were you finding yourselves absorbing this stuff and thinking, you know, there's something more that's missing that we're not talking about? Was that sort of informing at some point, leading you on the path to doing what you did? Were you conscious of it early on or at some point?
For sure, women are mentioned in the Beatles' biographies. Certainly, we hear about Aunt Mimi, we hear about Julia, we hear about their mothers and the impact that the death of both Julia Lennon and Mary McCartney had on John and Paul. We hear about the fans. We hear about all the main figures, Astrid Kircher. We hear about them. So I knew about them from the time I looked at this first Beatles book and then going into the other books that I came across. I have to say that my sister very early on bought a paperback edition of Cynthia Lennon's A Twist of Lennon. And I remembered maybe I would have been 10 or 11 or 12 sort of looking through it, but I didn't do any sort of close reading of it at that time. So I knew that there were these female figures and voices within the Beatles story, but I just always felt I wanted to know more. And for instance, I would think about the women at the Cavern, especially when I was older. I would say when I was at university and I was playing music myself and I was involved in a local music scene, I would think about and ask myself, what would that have been like to be part of a local music scene where the Beatles happen to be the core of that scene, right? They're the focal point of that scene. And interacting with them as just these local guys, you know, how interesting. And I just felt like I wanted to know more from that perspective, for instance. And I think I told you, I'm just rewatching Anthology. My husband and I have been watching it this week. And in, I can't remember which episodes, but they're some of the first ones where they interview a local Liverpool fan. And she's saying how sad she is that the Beatles no longer belong to them in that sense. You know, they belong to the world at this point. But, oh, I wish they'd come back and be our Liverpool band again, is essentially what she's saying. And I think when I saw Anthology when it first broadcast, I remember seeing that and thinking, yeah, what would that have been like? What would that experience have been like? And I promptly wrote this short story, I think the next day, trying to envision a woman who was middle-aged at this point, looking back at her teenage years as one of those girls at the Cavern and how that was such a formative experience. I never had that published or anything. It was really just for fun.
Do you still stand by it? Or do you look back and think, oh, well, now knowing what I know now?
If I wanted to write fiction like that now, it would be very different based on the research I've done and everything. But I think there were always things like that coming up, not just in the books, but in all kinds of Beatles media. Where I wanted to know more, I had more questions. I did have questions, for instance, like, did girls form bands because they loved the Beatles? I always had heard about these garage bands that formed that were all guys. But what about the girls? There must have been girls who wanted to do that. So that was a question that came up again, I think, in my later teens when I was starting to play in bands and things like that. And the other question I had was also, were there fans in the late 60s who actually really liked Yoko? Because I felt like there was always the bad press and all the negativity surrounding Yoko. But I wondered if there were kind of these more artsy bohemian Beatles fans who thought she was great and didn't have any bad feelings about her during that time period, you know, 68, 70. Maybe right after the Beatles broke up too, because obviously that narrative of quote unquote Yoko broke up the Beatles has been such a strong one. And just the negativity around her name, even just using her name. For instance, one of the women I interviewed for the book said she actually coined this term Yoko'd because she'd go to her husband's recording sessions with him, even though she had also been a musician, performing in bands, doing her own thing. But sometimes she would go with her husband to his band practice and his bandmates would disparagingly call her Yoko. Oh, Yoko's here. So she said, I've been Yoko'd. What the hell?
It's funny. When I was in Vans, we were past the Yoko thing. You'd be Janine'd from Spinal Tap if that sort of thing happened.
It might have been better if the album had been mixed right.
It was mixed wrong, wasn't it?
You can hear the lyrics on all of it.
You don't agree that you can't hear the vocals?
No, I do not agree, no.
I think maybe it's interesting that she's bringing it up.
Well, she'd like to hear the vocals.
I mean, it's like she'd saying, like, you know, you're using your own conditioner for your hair. You know,
You don't do heavy metal in Dublin, you know?
In Dublin? She means Dolby, all right? She means Dolby. You know exactly well what she means. We shan't recover from this one.
Oh, come on.
Right. And again, you see Yoko's name being used in this way, or that image of her being this disruptive girlfriend at band practice or in the whole band story. You see that in Flight of the Conchords as well. There's a whole episode called Yoko that's about one of the guys in the group has a new girlfriend and wants to spend all his time with her. And even after I wrote the book, I rewatched Friends, which I hadn't seen, I think, since it was on the air. But I watched the whole thing from start to finish. And there's an episode early on where Phoebe is called Yoko.
Hi, man.
Yoko.
Because she's partnered up with this guy who's supposed to go on a big research trip, and is she preventing him from going? So the fact that Yoko's name has been sort of dragged through the mud all these years, and that growing up as a Latter-day fan, you would hear that so much. And that's why I was really curious, you know, surely not everybody held this view of Yoko. And sure enough, for whatever reason, that kind of information hadn't been uncovered. But when I read Viv Albertine's memoir, she was the songwriter and guitarist in the punk band The Slits. She talks about being a huge Beatles fan as a child. And when Yoko came along, she thought she was fantastic. She thought she was the perfect partner for John, that she was this really out of the box, super fascinating person, and that she and her friends all admired Yoko. That's what she shares in her memoir. And when I read that, I thought, finally, it's great to see this in print, because I just thought that was a question that was constantly bothering me. Why is it that just hearing so much negativity, surely that can't be the whole story in terms of the fan community? And then when I conducted the interviews, especially, I would say, the younger generation of fans, again, tended to have more positive things to say about Yoko and really saw her as an icon. And I think that's even more so with these younger women, again, who I've met through Twitter and podcasts. There are definitely younger women out there who very much see Yoko as an important figure in her own right, but also really love that she entered the Beatles story and that she was such a prominent figure within that story as well. So yeah, I guess when I was going through all Beatles media and literature when I was younger, there were definitely questions that had a lot to do with women in the story. Astrid Kircher, I guess because I'm half German and I've spent a lot of time in Hamburg and in Germany, I always was fascinated with that connection the Beatles had with her and the connection they had with Hamburg and what an important place that was. But I always wanted to know also more about Astrid and just more of her impact and influence on the Beatles as well.
I am not a psychologist, but I've always had the suspicion that John wanted an Astrid of his own, and that was part of the attraction. His closest and most respected friend, Stuart, that was what he discovered and connected to. And she validated him as an artist and was his co-collaborator. And John didn't have that. And I think that there was a part of him that needed that validation as an artist and ultimately found it with her. And it's so ironic, the characteristics that Yoko brought with her. Another older woman, member of an Axis country, exotic artist. Yeah.
That's right.
But I would love to do a Yoko show sometime, as I've mentioned to you before, but I want to cover the book first. So I think it is a fascinating thing. It is an absolutely fascinating thing because it's so not cut and dried. It is so complex.
It is so complex. What I think is so tremendous about looking at the romantic partnerships, because obviously the Beatles fan community, everybody has always been interested in those relationships. And obviously some people gravitate more towards, say, Cynthia's part in the story or Patty's, or, you know, are fascinated with Jane Asher, and then Yoko and Linda for sure. But for me also, what was so interesting about it as a sort of youth culture historian or cultural historian is the sort of changing dynamics between men and women and those sorts of relationships during the 1960s. And again, this is where we see the Beatles being very forward-thinking, John and Paul choosing these women to be their wives, their romantic partners, their life partners, these very unique individuals who they wholeheartedly love for all of who they are as people. And there's that attraction to them in terms of not just their personalities and other kinds of attraction, but just really embracing them as people and finding them so interesting and so different. And that says so much about John and Paul, you know, and their choice of partners, that they were really attracted to those individual qualities that both Yoko and Linda had that maybe onlookers didn't understand, they didn't want to understand, they didn't know. Because I think there's always that stereotyping that people do where they think, especially with celebrities, you know, so-and-so has partnered up with this person. Why? Why have they partnered up with this?
They could have anybody. Why'd they settle on this?
Exactly. Right. But I mean, even, you know, sadly, this is something that goes on in friendship circles, you know, like, why is so-and-so going out with him or her? I don't understand. I don't get it. And obviously, when you're looking at celebrity culture, that's large. But I always thought these are creative geniuses. These are really interesting people, all of them. Why wouldn't they want to partner up with someone who compliments and challenges them at times, perhaps, or really brings out the best in them? And I think probably they both felt that they had found people who did that and that they could have these creative adventures together, which they clearly did. And that is unprecedented, of course, in rock music history. These two men in this case, the most successful band in the world, the band breaks up, they go on and do creative projects with their wives. I mean, can you think of another example of that?
I can think of plenty of anti-examples of that. And Mick Jagger's quote, I would never have my old lady in a band.
Right.
Women. Just women. Getting in the way. Cher Shalo fan, you know.
End of part one. Intermission.
Something About the Beatles, created and hosted by Robert Rodriguez, executive producer Rick Way, title song by The Corgis.
Love
So, tell me about last night.
Well, it wasn't what I expected. It had the perfect amount of spice.
Sounds hot.
It had all the flavor, and I wanted more. The ghost pepper wings from Popeyes are just so delicious.
Wait, I thought you were talking about your date.
Sometimes, things aren't always as they seem. Like Popeyes ghost pepper wings that have the perfect level of kick and flavor. Try them for only $5 today. Limited time at participating U.S. restaurants. Price may vary. Tax extra.
Love that chicken from Popeyes.